Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist Bumper Christmas Edition, episode possibly 9, The Last Dodo by Graham Lawton, a unique specimen of the iconic bird, has a more checkered past than anyone imagined. In 1598, a squadron of Dutch ships landed on an uninhabited island in the middle of the Indian Ocean. The crew put ashore and discovered an abundance of wildlife, including a great quantity of fowl, twice as big as swans. They killed and ate some, but the meat was not so good, so they killed and ate some parrots and pigeons instead. The Welgulvel, meaning tasteless bird, was off the hook for now. Within a century, however, it was not so more. Its chicks and eggs had been predated more and more successfully by invasive rats, cats, dogs and pigs, and its inhabitants of the once pristine paradise of Mauritius was destroyed. Also, Mauritius was uninhabited. Oh, well, there you go. The last recorded sighting of the bird, now known as the dodo, was in 1662. At that time, nobody noticed or cared. My first sighting of a dodo came earlier this year in Oxford, UK, and I very much noticed and cared. Like many people, I had assumed the dodo specimens were to a penny. They aren't. They're, and the one at Oxford University Museum is a one-off. It's the only one to preserve soft tissues and hence could one day be used to de-extinct the dodo and undo the hungry Dutch sailors set in motion more than 100 years ago. That is for the future, although for now what makes the Oxford dodo especially fascinating is its past. It turns out that it isn't on the public display. It's kept in a specially made box stored in a secret location. I was shown in the museum historic Huxley room where, in 1860, Thomas Henry Huxley, Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, famously exchanged barbs during the debate on evolution just after The Origin of Species was published. Talk about bucket lists. One of the complete, that's what he wanted to do, one complete specimen, all that remains is a skull and skin attached to the right side of the mummified skin on the left side, part of an eye, skeletal foot and some leg bones, one feather and various scraps of flesh. But given what the bird has been through, even that is remarkable. Accordingly, to receive wisdom and the Museum of Dodo's exhibit, it was one of a few birds to make it off Mauritius alive, arriving in London in around 1636. It was acquired by John Tradescant, natural historian, collector of curiosities, and King Charles I's gardener. On his death, Tradescant bequeathed his private museum to Elias R. Schmoll, whose collections eventually became renowned as Schmollian Museum of Foxford, Cabinet of Wonders. This is implausible, but it's half-truth at best. Tradescant travelled widely to collect specimens of his Wunderkammer, Cabinet of Wonders, and only one of its kind in England at the time. Okay. It was kept in a house in Lambeth, then a village south of London, and became a tourist attraction. However, amongst many contemporary accounts from visitors, none mentioned the dodo or anything that could be mistaken for one. When Tradescant died in 1636, his collection passed to his son John the Younger, also a naturalist and royal gardener. Tourists continue to flock to the house, but visitors, including a delegation from the Royal Society, don't mention the dodo in their accounts. Yet, in 1650, a rifle collector, aforementioned Ashmole, paid a visit. He persuaded Dresden to catalogue his collection. When the catalogue appeared in 1656, included entry, Dodo from the island of Mauritius. It is not able to be far to fly, being so big. Whether or not the dodo was alive at the time wasn't recorded. There is no record of where and when it was. Oh, good God, poor dodo. Obtained, and whether it was even alive when it arrived in the country. Contrary to popular belief, very few live dodos were ever shipped to Europe, and the only one or two survived the journey. The most colourful idea is about the Oxford dodo's provenance. Has it as a live specimen seen in London in around 1638. A retired MP, Hamill Lestrange, describes visiting a house that was displaying a great fowl, somewhat bigger than the largest turkey cock. The keeper called it a dodo. It's possible that this bird ended up at Crescent collection. Another possibility is that it was collected by Emmanuel Altham of the Company of Merchant Adventurers of London, who visited Mauritius in 1638. He wrote to his brother that he was sending back a dodo as a gift, but there's no evidence that the bird ever arriving. The third possibility comes from Ashmolean Museum catalogue in 1836. It says that a diplomat called Thomas Hilbert, who visited Mauritius in 1629, probably brought the dodo to England. He described the bird in his travelogue and knew about Ashmole, a tradesman, the elder. But he did not return with the dodo. If he did return with the dodo, he omitted to mention it. Regardless of its provenance, in the 1600s, a dodo was just another exotic bird among many. It had yet to acquire its iconic status. What happened next, however, launched the dodo in a trajectory of international fame. Transient the Younger had no male heir, so promised to leave his collection to Ashmole. But when he died in 1662, his will bequeathed everything to his wife Hester. Ashmole disputed his claim through the court and won. Oh, poor Hester. Even as he was plotting against Hester, he was thinking about securing his legacy. He offered his collection and transferred to University of Oxford on the condition that it build a museum and name it after him. University took the bait and the Ashmolean Museum was created. In 1683, the collection, 12 cartloads, arrived in Oxford by barge. The dodo, unfortunately dead, was put on display. Taxidermy in those days was a haphazard affair, though by 1755 the specimen was beyond repair. It was supposedly thrown on a bonfire, but the flames rose. To its Roman nose. The curator dived in to save what he could. So the story goes. Mundane reality is that the unsavourable bits were discarded and the rest kept. For the next 70 years, the museum was in the doldrum of decline, known locally as the Knick-Knackery. Successive apathetic curators did little more than collect a dwindling entry. So this is, we've had a miraculous rain overnight. Here we go. Fees as the specimens rotted. Interest in the dodo was as dead as the proverbial. Yet by early 19th century, naturalists even doubted that it ever existed. There were only two known specimens, a shriveled foot in the British Museum, now lost, the Oxford dodo head, of which was rumoured to belong to a vulture, and the foot to a turkey. But in 1814, a long-lost skull turned up in the Royal Natural History Museum in Copenhagen, and in 1847, the upper portion of the beak surfaced in Prague. Biologists realised that the creature wasn't mythical, but extinct, a fairly new concept at the time, and scientific interest soared. A dodo of Wonderland. Then along came Alice in 1860. The Ashmolean biological specimens were transferred to a brand new Oxford University Museum of Natural History, which became a regular haunt of the Reverend Charles Dodgson, better known as Lewis Carroll. He was captivated by the dodo, perhaps because he had a stutter and would introduce himself as Charles Dodgson. Oh, isn't that beautiful? Then, in 1865, he put a fictional novel, one into Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. That same year, a hoard of semi-fossilised dodo bones was discovered in the swamp of Mauritius. They were snapped up by museums and put on display, and dodo mania swept the world. Although there are now dodo bones galore, the Oxford specimen is still special. The soft tissue that remains inevitably led to speculation that the DNA might be used to resurrect the species. In 2020, mitochondrial DNA was extracted and analysed, confirming that the dodo was a gigantic flightless pigeon. But a complete nuclear DNA sequence has yet to be obtained and may never be. This particular dodo was not in good shape. The DNA preservation-wise, rumour has it was boiled to get the flesh off, says Beth Schiber, University of California, Santa Cruz. Advances in sequencing technology could come to the rescue, according to Paul Smith, director of the museum. Even if bringing the dodo back to life is unlikely, says Shapiro, de-extinction is complicated. The bird is particularly complicated. Nonetheless, the Oxford dodo still keeps surprising. Last year, all ideas about the origins were thrown into a tailspin. To learn more about dodo anatomy, Smith's team put the head in an industrial-strength CT scanner. We wanted to get a three-dimensional model of the skull to share with other scientists, says Smith. They got it, but they also got an explosive shot. We saw these bright spots, which turned out to be small lead pellets embedded in the skin and the bone, concentrated at the back of the head and the top of the neck, he says. The dodo had been shot, although the pellets didn't penetrate the skull. The injuries would have been fatal. Oh, poor dodo. Now, this was one of the discoveries that leads to more questions than answers, said Smith. If the bird that Lestrange saw in London was on Earth, why would you shoot it in the back of the head? Now, he thinks it's the most likely explanation that the dodo was killed in Mauritius. But now, how was it brought back to in that condition? If the whole bird, it was a whole bird, and when it came to Oxford, the journey would have taken weeks. Smith and his team continued with their inquiries. The next step was to analyse the shot to work out where the lead pellets were mined. Each lead ore field has a different isotopic characteristics, and if we can prevent the shot, we might begin to tie things down, he says. We might be able to determine whether it's a Dutch shot, German shot, or an English shot. Another possible clue could come from ballistics. The pellets were tiny, just 0.7 millimetres diameter, and appeared to be specialist fouling shot, which had just been invented in the 17th century. This means that it would have been used as a gun design for killing birds. If shot can be tied to a specific type of firearm, that might help narrow down the suspects further. Beyond that, who knows? It begins to go into the category of perpetual mystery, says Smith. Perhaps the Oxford dodo will never rise like a phoenix from the flames, but the new techniques, there is always hope. Surely there's life in this old bird yet. What a fantastic story. Oh. It's showing Star Trek James T. Kirk boldly drinking what no one has drunk before, which is pretty amazing. A little drink here. Okay. The best drinks in this or any universe. Ron Cooper gets a taste of science fiction. Most intoxicating beverages reveal how you can make them at home. Pan Galactic. Gaggle Blaster. The most effective science fiction creates an entire world can imagine living in. The world I want to live in needs delicious drinks. Think the Pan Galactic Gaggle Blaster, created by Douglas Adam. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah. And described as the best drink in existence. No matter that drinking it is said to be like having your brains smashed out by a slice of lemon wrapped around a large gold brick. I want to try it. Same with the intoxicating brews enjoyed by the raging fleet of surviving humans in Battlestar Galactica. Then there's the frothy Bartha milk served to the wretched hive of scum and villainy in Mos Eisley Kinter's Star Wars, probably the most famous bar in the universe. And what about the warm beer served to the frozen planet Gethin in Ursula Gwynn's Left Hand Left Hand of Darkness? It comes with a spoon to crack the layer of ice that forms on the surface between sips, and making it truly multi-sensory experience. And New Sounders, we aren't content with merely imagining the drinks taste like. We've teamed up with cocktail designer Zoe Burgess, an award-winning Alitia Pip in London, to bring them to life. Burgess and her team use techniques of molecular mixology to investigate taste. We love to explore how the best flavours can be extracted from ingredients, he says. This is where science comes to play. Our centrifuge and vacuum distillation units are the heart of our lab. They allow us to work precisely and achieve our flavour goals. The Atelier PIP team has tested a range of flavours and alcohol combinations to recreate the science fiction drinks in their signature style. And in an act of supreme altruism, we at New Scientist have volunteered to test them. When our little embassy of three crosses interstellar space to visit the firm's kitchen, I'm delighted to see that the vacuum distillation units are named Pris and Rachel after the two replicants in Blade Runner. Okay, so that way, Pris and Rachel. We're clearly come to the right place. While the same technical kit can be used to prepare these drinks, they can all be recreated at home. And Burgess has avoided the use of exotic ingredients like liquid nitrogen. They can also be made in alcohol-free, either leave the alcohol out altogether or use a non-alcoholic substitute for the spirit or beer. In retrospect, it may be a wiser choice. Stumbling out after sampling all four high-strength concoctions, I feel like I'm on a planet with a different gravity than ours. Oh, okay. It's really interesting. This is intoxication, I think. Oh, dear. So here are the recipes. So we've done Dead as a Dodo, and now we're looking at these drinks. Bantha milk. Description. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, a species of huge, hairy mammalian evolved in a desert planet. The Bantha of Tatooine produce a rich blue milk that is said to be nutritious and boosts intelligence. In the absence of milkable Bantha, Zoe Burgess includes electrolytes such as sodium and potassium in her recipe, and uses red cabbage for its antioxidants, vitamin K content, and natural dyeing properties. So the ingredients are 500 grams of caster sugar, 25 grams of yogurt powder, 250 ml of tap water, 50 grams of sliced red cabbage, black cow milk vodka, 100 ml of mineral water with added electrolytes. Method: make the yogurt syrup by combining the sugar, yogurt powder, and tap water in a pan and gently heating while stirring, dissolving the sugar. Allow it to cool. In a blender, whiz up the cabbage and 30 ml of vodka. Strain through with coffee filter and store the liquid in a sealed bottle in the fridge. The cabbage will oxidize, so make the tincture fresh for each batch. The neat vodka, we suggest 35 ml rather than, what did they say? They didn't say 35 ml. And yogurt syrup in a highball glass and stir to combine. Add a dash of red cabbage tincture to colour the drink. Top with a chilled electrolyte water and serve. And tasting notes: comforting, sweet, but not too coiling. Surprisingly non-alcoholic tasting. Okay. Now that's from Star Wars. This is Ambrosa from Battlestar Galactica. Description. What's left of the human race is scuttling through space and searching for mythical planet Earth, chased by murderous, technologically advanced androids called Cyclones. Only the protection of an ancient military Battlestar Galactica stands between humans and certain death. It isn't surprising that the fugitive needs to drink. The fictional Ambrosa is green with a slightly sulphurous smell, which led Burgess to use De Rimbles San Luis Prosti Mescal as a base spirit. Okay, ingredients: 300 grams of cored green apples sliced and skin on, 110 grams of caster sugar, 300 millimeters of vera juice, 1 gram of malic acid, 10 grams of fresh chives, 1 gram of sprinter powder, whatever that is, 100 ml of filtered water, 30 ml of Drumbles Sand Siluit Postils Mescal, whatever that is, shows that I don't understand much of this. Combine the sliced apples, sugar, vera juice in a jug and cover and allow to infuse overnight. Add this mix to a blender along with fresh chives and malic acid. I wonder what malic acid is, I have to look up. Then blend it into a pulp. Strain through the muslin cloth. Retaining the liquid, keep the green juice in an airtight bottle in the fridge until needed. Combine the spirulina powder and water and stir well. Strain the solution through a coffee filter, retaining the liquid add mescla, 20 grams, 20 milliliters of green juice, and 2 millimeters of Spirulina solution into the destined short glass and serve. Tasting notes: complex and savoury, grassy, smooth, delicious. I think it's a 9 out of 10. This gets out of 6 out of 10, the Pan Galactic Gale Blaster. Provenance, where it comes from, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. As might be expected, the drink is invented by the Galactic President Zephyr Beeblebrox. This is a complex concoction with many components, not all available in this universe. To make it easier to work at home, Burgess has distilled the recipe down into a delicious but punchy gin and tonic. Patchouli shares flavours compounds with mint, making it the perfect choice to give extra impact from mint to the mint notes. 4 patchouli ice cubes made from frozen water and 10 microliters of food grade patchouli oil, whatever that means. 4 ice cubes infused with lemon juice. 50 ml of gin as Heyman's Old Tom. 120 ml of tonic water. 1.25 milliliters of hypermint float combined, 50 millimeters Fennet Banker Minta with 100 microliters of food grade birch oil. I don't quite understand this one. Almonds pickled overnight with lemons. If Angolian's sun tiger teeth are unavailable. Angolian sun tiger. Method. To make the ice cubes, combine 2 ingredients in a centrifuge flask. Spin at 450 RPM for 10 minutes, then using a coffee filter, remove the oil from the water. The resulting water will now be flavoured with patchouli oil. This is an ice cube tray and freeze. For those sadly lacking at home a centrifuge, substitute this with ice cube infused with lemon juice. And the ice cube in a highball glass, followed by gin, then tonic, and stir gently. Add the hypermint float and serve in a pickled almond on a slice. Wow, my God, that's a beast. It feels like my brains have been smashed out with a bottle of Listerine. They're going to give it a 6 out of 10, so it must taste like rubbish. Okay, Gethin Beer, Left Hand of Darkness. To mimic drinking the habits of the inhabitants of Gethin, Burgess created a creme brulee style drink with a malty beer soup under a crisp of sugar, sealed gently by heating with a blowtorch. The drink itself isn't hot, but the particular tincture provides a warming sensation. 300 grams of cream, 36 grams of full fat milk, 7 grams of black treacle, 2 egg yolks, 60 grams of caster sugar, 200 millimeters of beer, choose something with a good malty flavor, 1.5 milliliters per glass of hot paprika tincture, 20 grams of isomalt sugar. I wonder what that is. Now, malting is where you ferment the you ferment it before you do. Add the cream, milk, and treacle to a pan. Bring to a simmer and boil. Whisk in the egg yolks with the caster sugar to form paste. Slowly add hot cream to the mixture to the egg sugar, stirring constantly. Add the beer and stir and complete. Pour the mixture into a glass, adding the paprika tincture. Put it in the fridge and chill. The liquid will be semi-set. Finish the drink. Sprinkle with isomalt sugar on the surface of the liquid and melt very gently with a blowtorch. You want the sugar to liquefy and set, but ideally not to brown. Tasting notes: heavenly, and it's a 10 out of 10. I'm definitely making this one at home. More of a pudding than a drink, as is someone. It is pretty amazing, isn't it? But yeah, it's a 10 out of 10. The Pan Galactic Gale Blaster. It's not there. Okay. Next one is, so that's drinks and the dodo. The dodo is quite interesting. Okay. To save the future of cash, we should ditch our small school and introduce a new one, says Graham Lawthorne. Find a penny, pick it up, and all day long you'll have an annoying, practically worthless disc of copper, electroplated steel, rattling around in your pocket. Far from stooping to pick them up, most of us are actively trying to get rid of the luckless things. According to the UK Treasury, 60% of 1 and 2 pence coins are used once, then lost, stashed or thrown away. Last year, for the first time in decades, the UK Royal Mint didn't make any copper coins. They were already more than enough in circulation. So why doesn't the UK follow the lead from Canada, Ireland and many other countries and put these coins out of their misery? Change, it turns out, is hard. Over the years, the UK Bank of England, Treasury, Royal Mint and even the Prime Minister have thrown their tuppenny halfpenny worth of to defend the copper coins. One argument is that getting rid of them will cause inflation. Another is that it's good to prevent shops from selling goods at a magical, whatever it is, 99 price point. Now, though, there is a new reason to want to see the back of the coppers. It would ironically help save cash from being abandoned altogether. Finding a penny is one of the genuine slices of luck. A century ago, a British penny, then a 1/240th of a pound, was worth the equivalent of 20 pence, but today it is literally nothing you can buy with it in shops. The cheapest item on sale's UK leading supermarket is a sweet that would once have been called a penny tube. It costs 10 pence. This inevitable fate of small denomination coins, inflation gradually gnaws away at the purchasing power, rendering them obsolete. The last time the UK dropped one was in 1984, when the halfpenny was deposited in the great piggy bank of the sky. Since then, many other countries have taken the smallest coins out of circulation. So this is Belgium, which has binned 1 and 2 euro coins in 2014. What were euro cent coins? It didn't abolish the denomination. Cash purchases are simply rounded down or up to the nearest 5 cents. The winning solution, surely. So how long? Have 1p and 2p coins got? Don't cash your coppers just yet. Last year, the then Prime Minister Theresa May announced that the coins were safe for years to come. The decision was hailed by fans of cash, who said that the pinching pennies would have sent a signal to society no longer cared about 20% of people who rely on notes and coins. But according to Adam Townsend of Imperial College London, we have all seen we've all been shortchanged. Keeping coppers will ultimately hasten the demise of cash. To defend the coins and banknotes, there are many good reasons for wanting to do so. We should cull the weakest coins and introduce a new rather than old ones. At this point, it might be fun to ask yourself what coin would be the most useful addition. You might think the 99p or the US style quarter or the three pound coin. Don't put your money down just yet. Townsend's starting point was nothing to do with the cashless society, but instead a simple matter of annoyance. He was baffled and irked by supermarket self-checkouts, which dish out irrationally large quantities of cash. If you paid in cash, you never got 50p or 10p pieces, but a fistful of 20p's and 5p's and coppers. The reason is that the machines are made in the US, which has fewer coins in circulation than the UK, and so don't have enough change dispensing tubes for the UK 8-coin system. That led to a surprisingly fictitious question. If you made a purchase with cash, what is the average number of coins you expect to get back in your change? Being an applied mathematician, he described the use of real-world transaction data from the Office of National Statistics about cash value of actual purchases of goods and services. After crunching the large numbers, he found that the average number of coins you can expect in change in the UK is 4.61. This rises to 5.91 if you use a self-checkout. For comparison, he looked for other economies. The UK average is similar to other places with 1/5 coin systems in most Eurozone. US fares slightly worse at 4.75. For nostalgia fans, the peri-decimal UK currency comes in at 4.9. Worst of all is Japan, which uses 1/5 system and commonly in Asia pays an average of 7.51 coins per cash transaction. Coincidentally, the most change-efficient countries include ones that have recently phased out small coins: Canada 3.94, Sweden 2.32, New Zealand 2.69. Simply phasing out 1p coins would improve UK's score to 3.43, pounds in calculator. But we could do even better. As well as taking coins away, you could add them. So he also analysed the effect of introducing one new coin. This brought an unexpected result. The most efficient system would instantly reduce the average number of coins in change to 2.6, require the coin worth of £1.75. It's a bit of a silly number, he says. He admits that he can't imagine the checkout staff being happy to introduce such an arithmetically challenging coin, but points out it's simply a thought experiment. There is a genuine case for making cash more efficient and attractive, however. There are social reasons to encourage people to use cash, which is an argument for making coins better. Among these are privacy, security, the fact that many people still don't have a bank account. Of course, introducing the £1.75 coin wouldn't be a permanent fix. Inflation, like the death taxes, is inevitable. So the price transaction would gradually rise, rendering the £1.75 coin useless unless efficient. Yet, as Sandler points out, prices are to some extent influenced by coins in circulations. In the US and Canada, for example, Townsend observed that prices ending in 75 and 25 and 75 are more common than elsewhere, driven by quarter coins. The 1.75 coin would temporarily stabilize prices around this multiple, he says, but not forever. Once the copper is gone, the 5p will be next in line for the chop, and even the £1.75 coin will be eventually considered worthless. By then, our loved 1 or 2p's may well be collector's items, with more than the old £1.75 coin was introduced for some stupid reason all those years ago. So next time you see a penny in the street, pick it up and put it somewhere for posterity. Isn't that amazing? That's amazing, the copper coins. We've got no copper coins in Australia whatsoever. And I think that's the end of this New Scientist. There's back pages, there's sort of interesting stories. There's pictures of different atoms. One atom gives another an electron. The other atom seems really grateful, but uses a gift to wrap up a coffee, to swap for a coffee maker. What? It's quite that's quite funny, I think so. Feedback. It's got about the ant tetrahedron. I'll just read this through. Two spiders are patrolling up and down a wire, each, removing them from the possible routes of the ant. The four remaining wires are connected. So, two spiders patrol up and down a wire each, removing them from the possible routes of an ant. Okay. The four remaining wires are connected on the top of the top of. Oh, yeah. Okay. Some sort of tetrahedron. Yeah, okay. Keep going around, eventually catch the slightly slow ant. To prevent the ant quickly darting onto their wires to get behind the chasing spiders, the first two spiders should reach the end of the edges to meet the third spider as it goes past. I don't quite understand. Oh, this is the answers. Oh, these are answers there. Okay, well, okay. Okay. So these are some quite good puzzle questions which they had out for people. And it's something really curious to answer. It's interesting how people just cannot even comprehend a scientific puzzle. Thanks a lot for listening. That's the end of this New Scientist.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.